Okay, well, I'm going to start with a poem written in 1957 by a non-Aboriginal worker. And it was published in a little publication called Everly News. Railway Workshops, which was big railway workshops in the centre of Sydney. And there was a strong union organisation there, and they had a cross-union delegates meeting, and the Everly News was their little regular newsletter that they put out to all their members in the railway workshops. And this was a poem published in it. It says, "Driven from their tribal lands by men who planned for war, into arid lands around them, to hunger, pain and more, proud in tribal legend, on sacred ground they tread, commuting with their spirits, their totems and their God. So let us raise our voices in answer to their pleas to make them equal citizens in this country of the free." And the workers were protesting about nuclear testing at Woomera. They held a mass meeting and sent off an angry letter to the Prime Minister Menzies about this, imposition on Aboriginal people at Woomera. And so, whatever you think of the poem, actually it supports Aborigines' right to their land, to their own culture, an identification with their suffering, and support for their demand for citizenship, which was becoming, the main demand and became a reality in the 1967 referendum. And so I thought that this is a good place to start in an interrogation of the ideas of autonomous organising, ideas that say that the oppressed should organise separately from other people and remain autonomous. And this is based on an assumption that whites benefit from oppression of, blacks or Aboriginal people, men benefit from women's oppression, straights from gay oppression, and therefore they can't be part of the struggle to free people from their oppression. Now, the first thing I want to say is really that there is no such thing as an autonomous movement of the oppressed. No movement exists in isolation from the wider social situation. They rise and fall along with other movements, with political developments, with the levels of radicalisation, with victories, or they decline with the defeats and with, retreats. So, for instance, the women's movement in Australia burst into history with, the second women's movement, the one we call the Women's Liberation Movement, burst into history with trade union militants such as Zelda Duprano, a Communist Party member, chaining themselves to the front of the arbitration court demanding equal pay. Now, contrary to feminist historians like Marilyn Lake, feminists did not win equal pay. Many of them obviously did campaign for it, but the unions had been campaigning for equal pay for decades. And in 1958, in fact, women in New South Wales, in some industries such as teaching, had got equal pay mainly because of union activity. And during the 1960s, to give you an idea of the level of activity by unions on a regular basis, from 1960 on, they had a union radio program, at least in New South Wales, on a weekly basis. The ACTU staged an equal pay week every year in which they had rallies, and it was very radical to have a rally in those days, meetings, petitions, putting up submissions to government and all the authorities. And male officials of the trade unions often led these campaigns, organised the activities, and rank-and-file male workers were expected to be involved in them. If you read Marilyn Lake's history of feminism in Australia, there's this seamless narrative of feminists irrevocably fighting for what we know was the end result of a certain degree of equal pay. But actually, during World War II, unions were campaigning for equal pay for women, because women being drawn into the workplace to replace men are fighting. Now, feminists such as Jessie Street actually refused to back the claim for equal pay. They represented a middle-class United Associations of Women, and Jessie Street argued in the court case that was held in the 1940 basic wage case. She argued for 60% of male wages for women with 5% yearly increments after that. And Janie Stone, a Marxist, says in a comment on this, "The unions were furious as they had been arguing for equal pay, but the publicity for a gradual approach weakened their case. The UAW's class-based concern for the ability of the employers to pay outweighed..." The UAW's class-based concern for the ability of the employers to pay outweighed their support for equal rights. And more importantly, working class organisation gave the campaign the strength that feminists never could muster. So those examples start to make some of the points I'm going to be hammering. Because to the extent that the court decisions in 1969 and then again in 1972 granting equal pay became a reality in the workplaces, it was actually industrial campaigns of unions that made this translation possible. In one of those campaigns, which is documented actually by Diane, who's chairing, I'm not sure whether it's in Rebel Women or in her thesis, but I've read it anyway. It's clear that... So it must be right, Diane wrote it. Yeah. It's clear that the idea that only women should or would fight for women's rights had to be defeated. This idea had to be defeated if they were ever to win equal pay in the campaigns by the unions. In the insurance industry in the mid-1970s, some women, especially the managers, actually didn't support equal pay, whereas most left-wing men did support it. And so it's obvious where your allies were, because excluding the men from a campaign for women's rights was absolutely ridiculous. And the lessons were even more dramatic in the Amalgamated Engineering Union, which was the precursor of the Metalworkers Union. And it was metalworking skilled tradespeople, mainly men. They had 2,000 women out of a total of 8,000 members in 1969, whereas in the insurance industry they had 50% women. And the thing that determined the success wasn't the numbers of women in the or the independent organising of the women, but the levels of militancy. And the insurance industry had a conservative history. The AEU was known for its left-wing leadership and militancy, including industrial action over equal pay well before 1969. And in this union, men at times actually took strike action, losing pay, in order to win claims for better conditions for the women members, even though they were to get no benefit for themselves, the male workers. And through industrial action, by 90% of the union's women members had equal pay by 1972. And this was very important because the metal workers actually set a benchmark. The wages and everything were much more regulated through the courts, and what the metal workers got was always seen as a base on which other workers could try to campaign and keep up with the need to get pay rises. And so the results of the... But the other point I want to draw out is that the results of the two campaigns actually included gains that exceeded just the money that they won for the women. Male workers couldn't just go around treating women in a sexist way that they'd been used to in the olden days, as my grandson calls them. The union journals no longer ran sexist cartoons after these campaigns, or the jokes that had been, quite prevalent in the journals beforehand. And the unions began to appoint female organisers. And so I think these outcomes demonstrate the destructive influence of ideas that would restrict organising around women's issues to autonomous organising, organising just women independently from the men. Because if you ignore opportunities to draw men into the campaign of solidarity and the opportunity to challenge their sexist assumptions, virtually this is tantamount to sabotage of the fight for women's liberation. And to say nothing of the growth of the confidence that women get from finding that they can find allies, that they have allies amongst the men of their class to fight for their rights. Now, Marilyn Lake tells us none of this history in her history of Australian feminism. She simply claims that equal pay was won by traditional feminist modes of doing politics, which included public meetings, protests and lobbying. So, you know, I'm not sure what makes this feminist. And so what you see is that the theory of autonomous movements leads to a rewriting of history, you know, and ignoring a whole lot of facts. And then that is used to justify the theory. So you falsely claim that feminists won equal pay, and this shows that women should organise autonomously around feminist politics if we want to win women's rights. And apart from that, it doesn't actually help explain women's activity, let alone how we might actually fight to and win. Because it wasn't any coincidence that we had women chaining themselves to the arbitration court in 1969. We had, by then, for years, the unions had been hamstrung by anti-union laws known as the penal powers, and there'd been growing restlessness amongst the rank and file, and especially with the union officials, for hiding behind these powers and saying you couldn't do anything. And people could see that while they accepted these penal powers, they were never going to get the benefits of the long boom that had now been going on for over 20 years. And so you had this general restlessness at the, you know, amongst the rank and file of the unions, and the women's action reflected that. So you can see, you know, it doesn't just happen in a vacuum, and it's not autonomous from what's going on. But it wasn't just in union campaigns, it isn't just in union campaigns that the ideas of autonomous organising are contradicted. In the 1960s and 1970s, a campaign for abortion rights for women really took off. And who was the key person in this campaign who put abortion on the political agenda of Australia? It was a doctor called Bertrand Wainer. And he was the key figure that made and fought for women's right to abortion. Obviously, women were involved, but he was the key figure. Now, most advocates of the autonomous organising today don't make very theoretical arguments, but we need to know something about the roots of the theories that promoted it. It started off with theories that promoted social movements as the new way forward in place of working class struggle. And they became popular in the 1980s because after the decline of the movements, you had certain demoralisation. And the theories relied on a stereotype of the working class movement, saying that, oh, workers only fight around economic issues. Oh, poo. In 1987, ARENA, the sort of pseudo-Marxist type journal, they said, trade unions have been less interested in the pursuit of social justice than in defending their own members. Like, as though the living standards of millions of trade union workers is not a question of social justice. But the problem is this argument denies a whole rich history of working class support for campaigns of the oppressed. And the ideas of autonomous organising actually ignore a central problem that the oppressed face, which is that they don't always have much power of their own. And the ones that I'm going to look at today, you take Aborigines in Australia, less than 3% of the population. In America, the African Americans in the United States have hovered around 11% for decades. And even women have to confront 49 to 50% of the population, you know, as enemies, if you accept the idea that men benefit from their oppression. And I'd argue that the only movement of the oppressed that has the power to seriously do something about oppression, to win serious fundamental change, is the working class, an oppressed class, because they have the economic power, all the things that we've been talking about over the weekend, not just to overthrow the system, but to force reforms out of governments. And what's more, they have the ability to unite the oppressed, because the oppressed have members, in the work, all oppressed groups, some of them are workers at least, and usually a majority. Now, the other thing, part of the working class struggle is that dynamic of the working class struggle, the dynamic of which is towards, solidarity, that movements that don't achieve solidarity don't get very far. like racism divides them against their own interests, whereas if they can be united, they can, you know, actually fight for their interests. So racism is not in white workers' interest in the sense that, a boss over a worker, they have totally different interests. People in the oppressed groups, they actually do have counterposed interests. Members of an oppressed group that belong to capitalists and the middle class actually have interests that are counterposed to the working class members of that oppressed group. Now, and so because no struggle happens in isolation, they're always confronted by these questions of politics and the questions of class. And partly because of that, and as soon as you start fighting, you start to get some sense of what you need to win. All oppressed groups, you have always ended up turning to find allies in the rest of the population. But the question then is the politics that inform the movement and where they look for their allies. And the black civil rights movement of the United States and the Aboriginal movement here never were autonomous movements. I don't know whether people think they were and where the ideas of autonomous organising actually are based, but, you know, there is no evidence either that the more separately either Aborigines or African Americans organised from, you know, whites, that they did better. Really, it was a question of the politics and where they looked for their allies. And so I want to look at a few my experience of researching the union movement and its attitudes to the Aboriginal rights movement in the 1950s, which is the article Diane referred to. Because, like, the resistance by the oppressed themselves bring out the issues that have to be dealt with. So it goes without saying that there has to be, you know, a movement of the oppressed. If, you know, members who, people who don't belong to that oppressed group can't just fight for the rights of people on their behalf. But Faith Bandler, a Pacific Islander, was a tireless campaigner for Aboriginal rights from the mid-1950s, she highlighted this process by talking about events that woke people up. And two of the main ones that she included in her list was the 1945 strikes by Aboriginal pastoral workers in the Pilbara and the 1951 strikes in Darwin by Aborigines, organised by Fred Waters, an Aboriginal organiser with the Northern Australian Workers Union. And he was eventually banished from Darwin by the authorities and sent to a reserve 1,000 miles from his family home and his land. And widespread protests took place amongst union members all over the country. And Aboriginal rights groups were formed at this time in the Trades and Labour Councils in both Sydney and Melbourne. So it woke people up. And there was constant campaigning in which there was an intersection between the interests of Aborigines and Aboriginal workers and the working class protests and campaigns in general. And I'm not going to go into a lot of detail. You can read about it. I just want to give you the broad sweep of what I found with the beginnings of some research. I looked at the Waterside Workers, the Victorian Trades Hall Council, the New South Wales Trades and Labour Council, the New South Wales Builders Labourers, the Building Workers Industrial Union, which covered tradespeople, which were tradesmen in those days, the Bakers Union in a variety of places, the railway workshops at both Everleigh and in Newport here in Melbourne, the naval dockyards that existed here in Melbourne, in Williamstown, postal workers, teachers, the Trades and Labour Council in Newcastle, metal workers all over the country, plumbers, Actors Equity in New South Wales. And every one of these unions held workplace meetings, sent off protests to prime ministers and everyone under the sun. At times they levied their members with compulsory things, you know, donations that they had to pay to support campaigns by Aboriginal people. These things happened every time there was an issue about abuse of Aboriginal rights. From things like Albert Namatjira, the painter, he was jailed for giving grog to his family members. They protested all over the country about the wrongful trial of a black man for murder in South Australia, about which there's a movie these days, and about the nuclear testing on Aboriginal land. They gave money, for, a lot of them collected money for a car for a Northern Territory organiser of the Indigenous population there. They sent delegations to reserves where Aborigines were, you know, left to live and held under repressive circumstances. And then they would hold mass meetings in a whole, in workplaces all over the place, reporting back. And then they'd send in letters of protest to the appropriate ministers and demanding all the rights that, and things that needed to be done on the reserves. They demanded land, such as Lake Tyers here in Victoria, be given to the Aboriginal people. No ifs, no buts, give them the bloody land. And they campaigned for years about Lake Tyers. They demanded that the wages be paid directly to Aboriginal people instead of being put in trust camps. The Actors' Equity in New South Wales had a big campaign about it. And the list just goes on. So the idea that the Aboriginal movement would want to be autonomous from these campaigns is, to be frank, laughable. And it is to say, why bother? Because, you know, this gave the Aboriginal movement strength that they never could have mustered on their own. Now, before the rise of the, this was happening before the rise of the more radical movement of the 70s. But this regular campaigning actually laid the basis for, you know, workers to have some awareness of the issues that affected Aboriginal people around the country. And so the referendum in 1967 didn't happen just in a vacuum. It happened in a situation where lots of workers were very conscious of the, you know, need to pass this referendum. And Joe McGuinness, who's a famous Aboriginal activist and has his memoirs published, says about the work of the Aboriginal Advancement League in Cairns in the early 1960s, without the support of trade unions and a few parliamentarians who believed in the principle of a fair go, it's extremely doubtful whether any of the cases reported by the League to the Protection Authority would have got to the stage where a public inquiry was held, followed by action of some sort to punish offenders. The Federal Council for the Advancement of Aborigines, which was formed in 1958, saw its main supporters as the trade unions. You know, and this is not that at all workers in all times were, you know, anti-racist and organising support for the oppressed. But there were two points about it. The backward ideas could be overridden by an appeal to workers' sense of class solidarity and an understanding of oppression that is handed out to the, you know, the ruling class and their governments. They could relate to the needs of the campaigns when they heard the facts of what was going on. But also, the second point is the question of politics, because it's no accident that a lot of these unions that I looked at had, you know, leaderships that were either in and around the communist parties or at least on the left of the Labor Party. And the Northern Australian Workers Union is a good example because it's often referred to as the typical example of racist workers. Now, at times it's true. They tried to exclude Aboriginal stockmen from the pastoral industry at times, and they agreed to clauses in their award after equal pay was granted that made it easy for pastoralists to sack Aboriginal workers. But from 1946 to 1952, they campaigned for equal pay, and they had a determined national campaign to support strikes by Aboriginal workers, and these were the years where they had a Communist Party leadership. And invariably, the unions that gave the most support and the most consistent support were led by the Communist Party. For all its problems, you know, that we talk about at times, they actually could raise the levels of class consciousness. And Faith Bandler wrote in 1964 to one of the unions, among the trade unions, I think she was writing to the waterside workers, among the trade unions, the Waterside Workers Federation has a special place in my heart because it has so often been the first and most generous in response to our appeals. And she also made the point that they could be asked to direct all their efforts to vital areas where less politically advanced organisations, such as the churches, who are usually the ones promoted by historians as having done everything for Aboriginal people, where these organisations cannot be expected to help. Another activist in Sydney in 1966 wrote that the BWRU was one of the most consistent supporters of Aboriginal rights. And so the politics in the workers' movement then influenced workers' responses to the demands of the oppressed. But also, the politics that influence where the campaigns by the oppressed look for support makes a difference as well. Which is why, you know, again, that there's no such thing as some united or not autonomous campaign of the oppressed, because there's always debates about where to look for your support. And so I want to move on to the fight for black liberation in the United States. And I want to start with Marcus Garvey, a black leader in the United States after World War I, who formed the United Negro Improvement Association. Now, I raise him because he's often promoted by left-wing historians and activists as a great example of autonomous organizing, because he built the largest mass movement of African Americans to that date. But for all his talk of separate development and black nationalism, Garvey looked for allies amongst whites. But where did Garvey turn? He turned in 1914 to the British Secretary of State for the Colonies, and he pledged support for Britain's war against Germany. In the early 1920s, he increasingly identified white supremacists as the only true friends of blacks. In 1922, in the South, he thanked whites for having lynched race pride into the Negroes and met up with the second in command of the Ku Klux Klan. He said, "I regard the KKK, the Anglo-Saxon clubs and the white American societies better friends of the race than all other groups of hypocritical whites put together." And he denounced communists as more dangerous to blacks than any other group. And this at a time when the state was using deportation of militants to smash the working class struggles. And so you have to ask, who fought for the politics most in the interests of the mass of African Americans? Marcus Garvey, who by the mid-1920s was proclaiming himself a fascist admirer of Mussolini and Hitler, or W.E.D. Du Bois, the middle-class black intellectual of the 1890s and early 1900s, who did fight for black freedom, but backed Woodrow Wilson's entry into the World War I. Do we support them as having the answer to black liberation, or do we look to the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, a predominantly white organisation that in 1910 launched a campaign to recruit black workers, who never organised a segregated union in spite of the absolute repression and the pressure they were under Jim Crow laws, who stridently opposed sending any workers to fight and die in World War I. Would we choose either of those black leaders over Bill Haywood, a white organiser of the IWW, who, when invited to speak at a timber workers' union convention in Alexandria in Louisiana, convinced the white workers to break the law and to meet with their black workmates, an unprecedented occurrence in Louisiana at the time. So who had the most potential to win the black freedom? The organisations that promoted black capitalism and fascism, or the organisation of tens of thousands of workers that resulted in a major strike in which black, migrant, Mexican workers all refused to scab under horrendous conditions of repression, an organisation which could proudly say of this strike, "It is a glorious thing to see, the miracle that has happened here in Dixie. This is coming true of the impossible, this union of workers, regardless of colour, creed, nationality. To hear the Americans say, 'You can starve us, but you cannot whip us.' The Negroes saying, 'You can fence us in, but you cannot make us scab.' Never did the bosses expect to see such complete and defiant solidarity." Now, the whole history of the struggle for black liberation in the States is, like that, a refutation of the theory of autonomous organising and an illustration of the importance of the politics of class solidarity for the struggles of the oppressed, both in the negative and in the positive. And it's also an example of how the fate of the movements of the oppressed can't be understood and can't be built in isolation from the wider political context. Because if we move to the Cold War after the Second World War, from the mid-40s to the mid-50s, you know, a period of dreadful McCarthyist witch hunts where anyone who was slightly left-wing could be victimised. Manning Marable, a black activist and scholar, says in his book Race, Reform and Rebellion, that the anti-communist purge of the unions in this period was the principal reason for the decline in the AFL-CIO's commitment to the struggle against racial segregation. They were the main trade union federations. And in 1946, the facade of white supremacy was crumbling, yet for almost 10 years, there was no overt and mass movement which challenged racism in the streets. And Ahmed Shawki points out in his book that who promoted the, helped promote these witch hunts that had this consequence? Not just trade union officials who we expect to behave like, with treachery, it wasn't exceptional, but also liberal black politicians. But not just politicians who we might always think would be sus, also the most prominent black leader and trade unionist at the time, A. Philip Randolph. And he was joined by the National Association for the Advancement of Coloured Peoples and other middle-class black organisations who joined in the witch hunt, eager to prove their patriotism. The NAACP refused to assist the CP when its members were hauled up in front of the House Un-American Activities Committee. I hope people know what that represented. Because it was used to denigrate and besmirch the reputations of anyone who took a principled stand against the right-wing campaign. And they even abandoned one of their founding members, W.E.D. Dubois, that I mentioned, when he was indicted as an agent of a foreign principal in 1951, even though he was never a Marxist and never a member of the Communist Party, which was, they were code for someone's a communist. And Dubois himself pointed out that many blacks had become middle class with a stake in the system, and they hated communism and socialism, he said, their ideas that challenge capitalism as much as any white middle class American. So why did the destruction of the Communist Party as a force matter to the struggle for black liberation? Well, since its earliest days after its formation in 1919, it employed organisers to work among African Americans. And they had to go through a long struggle to work out how they understood black oppression and, what needed to be done. But then by the 1930s, with the growth of industrial trade unionism, they did very serious work, drawing thousands of black workers into the unions. And one writer says that by the end of the 1930s, over 9% of the Communist Party's membership were black, an impressive achievement given that blacks were only 11% of the population. Now, he writes, at a time when segregation was rampant, legal in the South, de facto in the North, the Communist Party was virtually the only integrated organisation in the country. To have this organisation purged from the unions was a catastrophic defeat for the struggle for black liberation. And if you read the article on Martin Luther King in the ISR, he, isn't always seen as a fighter for class, around class politics, but in the year or so before he was assassinated, with the 40th anniversary of which is on the 4th of April, he had begun to draw a conclusion that, all African Americans couldn't just unite and that actually you had to see society divided between at least rich and poor if he wasn't clear about class. But he actually did say, the writer of that article says, he died trying to build a multiracial working class alliance to fight for racial and economic equality. He'd been trying to organise a poor people's campaign, which had been troubled getting it off the ground. But he said, in a sense, you can say we're involved in the class struggle. And just before he died, there was a big campaign by sanitation workers in Memphis, all black, I assume, and he went to Memphis and he made a call for a general strike, which was like a shockwave through the black movement, that here was Martin Luther King calling for a general strike in Memphis. And he went there to be part of all that, and that was where he was assassinated. So we don't know how far he would have travelled on that journey to class politics. So it's not even as though the historical examples, don't contradict all the ideas about autonomous organising. It's not just that is quite baffling that these ideas continue to be popular. Because in 1991, I was involved in a debate with two women in the journal Heckett, Helen McCosher and Jan Petman, and they raised an agonized cry, which was prevalent at the time. It represented what people were saying everywhere. They wrote, "The identities associated with social movements have tended to be spoken of and acted on as if they were alternative or mutually exclusive definitions. This often implied binary oppositions, men against women, blacks against whites, immigrants against Australian-born, people with disabilities against the able-bodied, gay versus straights and so on. Thus, within social movements, there has been a fragmentation and the emergence of new collectivities of people around different shared identities. But even within these categories, there are still many other differences, class, age, and so on." And they said, "Indeed, the fracturing and fragmentation at times seems endless." Now, these identity politics played an absolutely increasingly destructive role. I was at feminist events where childcare was only offered for female children, so excluding women who stupidly had male children. Women who lived or socialised, don't laugh, this is true. This is part of the history of movements that absolutely disprove all the ideas of autonomous organising, and we're confronted with the popularity of autonomous organising on the campuses still today. And this is why we're so hostile to it, not because we're just sectarians or we don't support women's rights as our detractors like to slander us, but because these are the consequences of these politics. Women who lived and socialised with men were abused and attacked and tried to be driven out of the spaces that were exactly set up under the politics of autonomous organising, out of the women's rooms. I have never been so uncomfortable in my life anywhere as in a women's room on a campus when this was all going on. And as Makisha and Pittman said, the politics of guilt-tripping can become overwhelming, and some women then choose to opt out of the political process altogether. Now, we have to ask ourselves why this happened. Well, movements come and go. They go up and down, as I said, and we have to learn from the process, and people are tested when we respond to the opportunities and how we cope in the retreats. Can we keep alive the fires of resistance when it ebbs? Well, with the decline of the radicalism of the 70s, many intellectuals and student activists became demoralised, and that's why they began attacking the working class. The bloody working class that didn't make a fucking revolution. They're scum. We're going to find some other way to liberate ourselves. But the dynamic of this increasing retreat from mass organisation was, just continued a shift to the right. And the politics of autonomous organising are the politics of this demoralisation. They're the politics of moralism and self-pity. Because it's not as though the proponents of this theory can explain how women, isolated from men, can possibly win substantial reforms from the structures of oppression. I can't remember what that point is I was going to make. You made me mad by laughing at that, because this is not a joke. These are the consequences of these politics, and I'm going on a bit long, so I'll try and jump over a few points. But we have to see that they're the politics of what's easier. It's easier to blame other victims of the system than to take on the power of the people who caused the oppression in the first place. And if we're to break out of this cul-de-sac of infinite fragmentation to which identity politics led the movements, then we have to recognise the alternative, which is the working class. Now, this doesn't mean that workers everywhere and always are always rising up in arms to defend the rights of the oppressed. We know that people are subjected to the ideology of the ruling class, and they accept a lot of the ideas at times. It's a question of looking at the structural realities of our society and who has the potential to seriously do something about it. Because, again, these politics within the oppressed movement have consequences, and there is no such thing as uniting all of the oppressed across class lines. The example I gave in Hackett in the debate was, women at Monash University had been campaigning for things like better lighting and better public transport, which had been cut back because there'd been a number of rapes on the campus. And we went to the Reclaim the Night demonstration, and the Labor Premier, Joan Kerner, was on the platform. And the students began protesting and saying, she shouldn't be allowed on the platform. She's responsible for the cutbacks to public education that mean women are walking around the streets at Monash. And so there was a big row, and a lot of the activists, in particular the ones organising the march, concluded that the Monash students and those of us that were supporting them should leave the Reclaim the Night. And so, in my opinion, the men on the campus who'd campaigned tirelessly for all the demands that the women had raised, trying to defend women from the threat of rape and attacks on the campuses, were better allies than the organisers of the march on Reclaim the Night. But I want to finish on a bit of a positive note, because contrary to the accusations of those who support autonomous organising, recognition of class as the main divide in society is not to ignore the questions of oppression. Lenin himself said that any true revolutionary Marxist must be a tribune for all the oppressed peoples. And in fact, I'd argue that, seeing class as the fundamental divide in society, lays the basis to be able to work out a strategy for actually fighting for the rights of the oppressed, and where you can build unity and where you have to, look for allies. And the example I gave at the time in Hecate can be built on tenfold today. I referred to the fact that in 1991, when they bombed Iraq, to our absolute amazement, tiny little group of activists that had always organised anti-war and various things, we were flooded. Tens of thousands of people came onto the streets saying, no war. And if you look since then at, the millions who demonstrated against the Iraq war in 2003, the hundreds of thousands who have demonstrated to try to defend union rights, the tens of thousands who tried to protect the rights of David Hicks, the nurses and teachers who have been on strike in at least one or two states in the last, trying to lead the way for pay justice. In these campaigns and activities, we have the basis to build the levels of confidence, the organisation, the means to seriously defend the rights of the oppressed from where, whether it's on the grounds of racism, sex or religious persecution or whatever. And those who wanted the oppressed to huddle together in their identity groups and remain autonomous can't play a role in these fantastic mass movements. They're left on the sidelines. And I want to end again with a reference from the Black Liberation Movement in the States, this time from Eldridge Cleaver from the 1960s and 70s, who was a member of the Revolutionary Black Panthers in the United States. And he wrote an open letter to Stokely Carmichael in 1969, who refused to work with sympathetic whites. And he said, "You should know that suffering is colourblind." And he went on to argue that the victims of capitalism, of imperialism and its oppression need a unity based on revolutionary principles rather than skin colour. The Black Panther Party is able to sit down with whites and hammer out solutions to our common problems without trembling in our boots about whether or not we might get taken over in the process, which is one of the arguments for autonomous organising. You belittle the intelligence of your black brothers and sisters when you constantly warn them that they had better beware of white folks. And it's this confidence, this understanding of common oppression, which is the answer to autonomous organising and the beginning of a strategy to begin to attack oppression in all its manifestations and to pull it down root and branch, I would argue.